Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at DanaFarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. A fine-tuned machine, that's what this economy is, provided everything adds up right. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, the 25th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The White House released its budget proposal this week, as you know. We covered it pretty heavily on Tuesday. Some of the specific program items, some of the cuts, and some of the assumptions it makes about where this economy is going. First among those assumptions, a firm belief that this administration can get the economy growing at 3% a year. That is plus or minus the historical average since World War II, but it is also fully half again as much as the economy has been growing since the end of the recession. And that gets us to today and Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin on Capitol Hill saying once again that he is confident a combination of tax cuts and deregulation and trade policy is going to get us to that 3% growth, about which, fine, but what happens if it doesn't? Marketplace's Amy Scott gets us going.
When asked if 3% growth was unreasonable in today's hearing, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin anticipated his critics.
I know there are lots of economists who will give us reasons why structurally we can't grow at that rate.
One of them is Ann Owen, an economics professor at Hamilton College. It's true annual GDP growth has averaged 3.2% since 1947. But Owen says in recent years, productivity growth has slowed down. And how do you get more GDP with the workers that you have?
We have to make those workers more productive. And whether or not we can do that in the future, I think is pretty doubtful.
The plan counts on that 3% growth to produce an extra $2 trillion in revenue over the next 10 years. Presumably, people and businesses will pay a lot more tax if they're making a lot more money. That and deep spending cuts are projected to balance the budget. Hunter Blair is an analyst at the Economic Policy Institute, a left-leaning think tank. He says if that growth doesn't happen,
we'll get higher deficits and higher debt, despite the fact that they've already engaged in enormous, cruel spending cuts in their budget.
But let's say we hit that magic 3%. Lee Ohanian at UCLA says we'd see employment and wage growth we haven't seen since the Clinton administration.
Growth covers over a lot of faults, and that's something that I think we should all hope for. Will we get there? I don't know.
And so far, we don't have a lot of detail on how the Trump administration plans to get us there. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On the theory that nothing in this economy happens in a vacuum, here with the latest on the federal debt limit. Both Treasury Secretary Mnuchin and Office of Management and Budget Director Mick Mulvaney were on Capitol Hill this week sounding the alarm. They are worried Congress might have to increase the amount of money the government is allowed to borrow much sooner than they had expected. We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer to explain what's going on here.
It's happened to the best of us. We try to budget and plan, but somehow we come up short. Imagine being billions of dollars short. That's what happened to the Congressional Budget Office. It says the government collected $60 to $70 billion less in taxes than expected during the first 7 months of fiscal year 2017.
The cash balance of the U.S. Treasury is down almost by half from the beginning of this fiscal year.
Peter Cohn is an analyst at Height Securities. He says there are a number of reasons the government is raking in less tax money. For one, wealthy investors might be holding on to stock, not wanting to sell it, because they're hoping Congress cuts the capital gains tax rate. Those are the taxes you pay when you make money selling stocks. Frank Sammartino was an economist at the Congressional Budget Office and is now at the Urban Institute. He says investors might think they can save on taxes if they postpone stock sales.
If they think that, well, maybe the tax rates on capital gains are going to be lowered because of tax proposals, they may postpone that.
The tax proposals he's talking about, one is in the Republicans' Health Care Reform Act. It would get rid of a special capital gains tax on high earners that's part of Obamacare. Also, the House Republican tax overhaul bill would lower the overall capital gains tax to about 16%. Another reason investors might be holding on to their stock? The market's hot, says wealth advisor Jennifer Myers.
I think a lot of people are seeing the markets move up and saying, I don't want to miss out on the opportunity.
But all of this is a gamble. Who knows what the markets will do and when or whether Congress will finish its health care and tax overhauls. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Speaking of the markets, the buy word on Wall Street today, what? Me worry? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's been a pattern, shall we say, to most of the breaking news of late. Mid-afternoon here on the West Coast, early evening back east, the big stories drop with shocking regularity. It's anxiety-inducing, to be honest, but also curious in the timing. Marketplace's Adrian Hill checks it out.
Some breaking news has a timeline no one can control. Death is a good example. A person dies when they die. Other news?
This is CNN Breaking News.
Breaks when a newsmaker decides to break it, like when the White House decides to announce a piece of information.
A major development here this evening at the White House. The President of the United States has terminated the director of the FBI, James Comey.
The news broke about Comey's firing at about 5:50 p.m. Eastern time. And while we can't read the mind of the president and his staff, in general,
there are basically two times of day when newsmakers are most likely to time their news.
Paul Niwa is a journalism professor at Emerson College. He says the first window is around 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning. That gives reporters time to talk to their editors and get to a press conference. The second window is late afternoon, around 4 o'clock Eastern. Want to guess why?
Because it won't spook the markets.
The markets. The U.S. exchanges close at 4.
The investors have a moment to pause and digest the information before reacting to it.
But what about the scoops, the investigations, the stories the news outlets, the papers and broadcasters decide when to publish? Like the existence of the Comey memos, like President Trump sharing classified intelligence with the Russians.
Tonight, this exclusive Washington Post story is causing a major stir.
A developing story now from the New York Times.
That's ABC News and CBS News. Cliff Levy is deputy managing editor at the New York Times.
Your listeners should not assume that there's any sort of conspiracy to have everyone publish at 5 or 6 o'clock.
He says the paper puts their investigative stories out as soon as they're fully reported, not wanting to risk getting scooped by the competition. Sometimes, he says, timing has to do with when a reporter hears back from the subject of a story.
Any kind of scoop, you know, covering anything, we might inform them at, you know, noon or 1 o'clock, and then they might say, oh, we need a few hours to figure this out, to give you a response, and then by the time they get the response to us, it's 5 o'clock.
Pushing a story out in the early evening, says Levy, is far from ideal.
I would prefer we didn't publish at 5 or 6 o'clock.
Why?
Well, because the audience is starting to wane digitally at 5 or 6 o'clock. I mean, the optimal time to publish is in the morning.
Which brings us to another question about news timing. How is it that once one news organization breaks a story, other newsrooms get their own stories confirmed and posted and pinging our phones so quickly? Vince Gonzalez is a journalism professor at USC's Annenberg School. He says as soon as these stories break, beat reporters at other organizations are rushing to their sources.
And they're getting confirmations because there are people who have been waiting for those phone calls from reporters.
A story in a major outlet also makes other sources willing to talk.
I think it opens the floodgates. I think when one of the greatest things you can say to a source as a reporter is someone else has already talked, or look, here's someone else, maybe not identified, but confirming it in the Washington Post. Tell me, is this true? Is this not true?
One more thought about the timing of news stories. Those push notifications on our phones make us more aware than ever of exactly when a story breaks. That's the modern-day sound of a good old-fashioned news war. And it's a battle that isn't intentionally timed to the end of the day, even if it feels that way. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
So how do you cover breaking news when sources want to tell you everything except their name? Reading between the lines of anonymous sourcing, that's in the latest episode of our new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, me and Molly Wood. Subscribe, listen, marketplace.org/makemesmart. Not only is this economy changing, as we've told you I don't know how many times, but so too are the jobs in it, the kinds of jobs, how much they pay, and who's doing them. Also, the perceptions of some old line jobs aren't what they used to be. Specifically, some of them are hip now, desirable. That's the story sociologist Richard Osijo tells in his new book. It's called Masters of Craft, Old Jobs in the New Urban Economy. Young people with college degrees getting jobs as butchers or bartenders or master's distillers. Osijo is an academic, so he did his observations and his interviews, of course, but he did some hands-on training as well, specifically Dixon's Farm Stand Meats in New York City at Chelsea Market. Richard, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want you to start by telling me about how to make hamburger patties at Dixon's Farm Stand Meats in Chelsea Market.
Well, you have to start by grinding out your trim.
Yeah.
Then grinding it out another time, a little coarser, with 20% of the weight with bacon ends. Get it a little bit coarser, and now you have your ground meat for your hamburger patties. So then you want to roll them up into a ball, good and tight, no cracks in there. And then you put it in the press, press it down, and hopefully that's what you have. You have a perfect patty. Took me a little bit to learn that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a great passage in the book. You learn how to make a hamburger patty. But it sort of goes to the heart of this book, which is all about, as you say in your subtitle, these old jobs in the new urban economy that are a combination of hip and very crafts-based. They're hard to get right, as you demonstrated, and still quite popular, too.
I found across all these occupations is this, I guess, renewed attention to detail. They really reinvigorated them with this sense of meaning, this sense of craft, and this idea that the process that they were going through was going to enhance the quality and enhance the specialness of the products and services that they were going to provide.
And they are, as you point out in the book, and these are basically your words, they're not, you know, the good jobs that people want their kids to get, right? These are college-educated 20 and 30-somethings going into what is, in essence, blue-collar service work.
Yeah, many of them said to me directly, it took me a while to convince my parents that this was what I wanted to do. They eventually were able to convince their families that, you know, they're doing something creative. They're doing something innovative. It's not just serving drinks, but it's about providing an elite, high-end service.
The thing about these folks, though, that you write about, and you say this in the book, is that they've got the luxury of being able to do this, as opposed to the people who actually just have to do it to survive, to get by.
I really expected to see them kind of moonlighting, doing it, say, out of some kind of hipster irony or something like that. These are very serious pursuits that they wanted to be doing, and they could have been doing something else. So they were making these sacrifices, really. And if it didn't work out, well, they did have options going forward. But for a lot of people who are in service industry in general, that's not really the option that they have. They get these jobs because they can. but it's not necessarily something you would equate with upward mobility or anything like that.
Which goes to the next question, which is they're riding the trend now, right, where to be a craft distiller or a craft whole animal butcher is, you know, the it thing now. But in 25 years, where are these folks going to be?
That's a great question. I mean, right now we have a solid generation of urbanites who really kind of expect to go to a bar and see a cocktail menu. You know, we'll see if this next wave of young newcomers to the city have the same expectations, are going to want the same things. That will probably determine whether or not these occupations are sustained beyond the next decade or so.
It's a book called Masters of Craft, Old Jobs in the New Urban Economy. Richard Osijo is an associate professor of sociology at John Jay College in New York, also at the Graduate Center at the City University of New York. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Coming up.
You can pick up your toilet paper, you can pick up your Gatorade, you can pick up your gift card.
Convenient, yes. Profitable, too. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 70 points today, 0.3%, 21,082. The NASDAQ up 42 points, about 0.6%, 6205. S&P 500 up 10, 0.4%, 24.15. Since the CBO gave the House healthcare plan a checkup yesterday, a look at some big insurers today. United Health up 1.4%, Anthem delivered 0.7% to the good. Humana boosted about 0.25%. Mentioned the news cycle and all those headline pings. Adrian Hill did. Time Warner, through its subsidiary Attorney Broadcasting, which oversees CNN, gained 0.9%. Comcast, owner of NBC Universal, essentially unchanged. Bonds barely fell, so the yield on the 10-year T-note also barely did anything. Stayed at 2.25%, 2.25% on the 10-year. You're listening to Marketplace.
From news to numbers, you count on Marketplace to explain what you need to know. Get Marketplace delivered to your inbox every day and never miss a beat. Subscribe to the newsletter at marketplace.org.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Come January next, California is going to be the biggest state in the union to have legalized recreational marijuana. This being the capitalist economy that it is, that's a business opportunity for entrepreneurs and a revenue opportunity for California towns and cities fallen on hard times. Towns like Adelanto, California, up in the high Mojave Desert, that had been teetering on the edge of bankruptcy and nearly ending its relatively short life as a city. David Weinberg from KCRW here in Los Angeles has the story.
The western edge of Adelanto is an industrial part of town, home to a handful of warehouses. There's a company that makes pools, a drone manufacturer, a strip club, and California's largest immigration detention facility. But the vast majority of the area, like the rest of Adelanto, is empty desert land dotted with Joshua trees. Though lately, there's been a new addition to the landscape. Lots of big yellow tractors. They're clearing plots of land for new warehouses to grow and store marijuana. Land prices in this part of the city have skyrocketed. Some plots have quintupled in price since the city announced plans to allow marijuana cultivation here in what is now called the Green Zone.
We had 53 people apply for cultivation permits. 43 have been approved. I believe there's only one that's actually legally up and running right now.
Jermaine Wright is a city council member, and he's the person who wrote City Ordinance 545, legalizing marijuana cultivation in Adelanto.
We make a projection on the low side. The larger facilities should be bringing in about $75,000 every 3 months to the city in tax.
If those predictions are accurate, tax revenue from weed businesses alone could reach $12 million by the end of next year. Just to put that in perspective, the entire Adelanto city budget last year was $13 million. And this potential flood of cash could not have come at a better time. In 2014, the city was nearly $4 million in debt and had begun the process of basically giving up as a city, filing for bankruptcy. The unemployment rate is double the national average, and more than 40% of the residents live below the poverty line. At a local Little League game, I talked to a few parents, and they had a range of opinions. Some were adamantly opposed to welcoming weed companies. Others, like Vicky Berrigan, said she was concerned about how it would affect her 9-year-old daughter, but she also saw the potential economic benefits.
That's a plus. There's going to be jobs available, and that's something to think about.
For all those jobs to materialize, a lot of things have to go exactly as predicted. And predictions are a tricky thing in America's rapidly changing marijuana industry. Bo Kilmer is co-director of the RAND Drug Policy Research Center. He says the federal government could crack down on growers, but there's also a worry that things could go in the opposite direction. What if, down the road, the feds legalize marijuana in every state and growers can ship it across state lines?
It's not entirely clear to me where the optimal place is to do that type of production.
For now, California is the largest grower and consumer of marijuana in the country. And state lawmakers plan to have new rules in place legalizing recreational pot by January. Cities like Adelanto that have a head start on building legit marijuana infrastructure hope to capitalize on the coming changes to the law. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
On the theory that business and economics can occasionally be opaque, we've got a series we do every now and then. Your questions, our answers. It's called I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blame work.
Say you're driving your kid to school and you suddenly remember, oh man, it's the teacher's birthday. Luckily, you can swing by the drugstore or the supermarket and buy a gift card for any number of restaurants, online stores, or brick-and-mortar retailers, which gets us to today's I've Always Wondered listener question.
Hi, I'm Mark McCullough from Miami, and what I've always wondered is why stores sell gift cards for other stores, example, at grocery stores and gas stations. What profit do the stores make selling a gift card for another store, and why does that store allow a gift card to be sold at another location?
Marketplace's Andy Euler took that one for us.
There's a thing that showed up in the greeting card section at a lot of stores about 15 years ago. There's one at this Target in downtown Los Angeles. It's a wall as tall as a person with hooks full of plastic cards. John Jenkins and his daughter are standing right in front of it.
Yeah, just trying to find something different for a gift.
There are dozens and dozens of cards here. iTunes, Starbucks, Netflix, cards for restaurants, Harley Davidson, even Facebook. This display has even got a name, Gift Card Mall. It's like a store within a store, and John Jenkins is happy it's here.
Definitely convenient for me. Do some shopping and get the gift card all at the same time.
He and his daughter stare at this little spot at the end of the aisle for a good 10 minutes. You remember when, in order to get a gift certificate, you had to go to that particular store and some poor clerk would fill it out by hand? Shelley Hunter knows how we got from there to here. She's a former product analyst and now writes for giftcards.com as the gift card girlfriend.
She says the shift to plastic actually started with Blockbuster Video.
They were having all sorts of problems with people making counterfeit gift certificates. And so they were the first company that converted to a plastic gift card that ran through the cash register. So it was really basically a fraud prevention measure.
It worked. All the big brands adopted it. So how did their different gift cards end up in the gift card mall like the one at Target? A third-party broker. Two major companies manage and distribute these gift card malls in the U.S. Blackhawk Networks is one. Terry Jack is their chief marketing officer.
We get the cards, produce the cards, process the cards, develop racks that were easy to shop, merchandise those racks. We basically come at it with, grocery store, don't worry, we'll take care of everything and we'll get this category up and running for you so it's really a nice value add to your customer.
Brands pay Blackhawk to get in the gift card mall. Blackhawk passes some of that money on to the stores that host the mall.
Whosever card that is, they have decided that the extra distribution in the grocery stores is worth them giving up a little bit of their margin on that card.
Blackhawk also acts as the go-between for the brands and the retailers on what to include or not. In Target, you won't find an Amazon or Walmart gift card. If Blackhawk Network doesn't sound like the name of a nice, friendly gift card company, well, it didn't start there.
It started actually with phone cards. Long-distance cards and the international calling cards where a lot of these companies began.
Ben Jackson follows gift card developments for Mercator Advisory Group. He says prepaid calling cards gave Blackhawk expertise in processing transactions.
And then they slowly expanded into gift cards.
Now, gift cards make up a $100 billion industry. They're everywhere. At a CVS in Los Angeles, I asked customer Marcelina Shavira if she ever stops at the gift card mall.
If you're in a hurry and you forgot it's somebody's birthday, and you can pick up your toilet paper, you can pick up your Gatorade, you can pick up your gift card for whoever likes whatever specific gift card they have on the stand.
It's certainly convenient for the customer. It makes money for everyone involved with just the slightest bit of aisle space. Is it the ideal personal gift? No. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
The subtitle on this series is Your Questions, Our Answers, so send them to us. Would you tell us what you have always wondered at marketplace.org? Final note on the way out today, in which everything can become a branding opportunity. You've heard of the events in Montana of last night, I'm sure. GOP congressional candidate Greg Gianforte has been charged with assault for going after a reporter who was, by the way, asking him about his thoughts on the CBO score of the House health care bill that came out yesterday. Anyway, Ben Jacobs, the reporter, tweeted after the incident that Gianforte had broken Jacobs' glasses in the course of body slamming him. Cue up Warby Parker, the eyeglasses company, which tweeted this morning that they are on it to get Jacobs a new pair of spectacles. All right, that is all we've got. Today, the Dow up 70 points, about 0.3%. NASDAQ up 42 points, 0.6%. S&P 500, 10 points higher, 0.4%. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Tro are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor, for now, you know, John Gordon. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.